Hello, I'm William Seaman, and this is a special KABU Public Affairs feature, Focus on Israel-Palestine. This series of programs looks back on the highly publicized Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Leading up to and during the withdrawal, the world's news organizations descended upon Gaza to produce interviews with Israeli settlers describing their anguish at being forced from their homes, homes some of them had occupied for three generations of their families. During the evacuation of these settlers, the images beamed out of Gaza were of unarmed Israeli soldiers removing settlers, dramatic scenes of soldiers embracing settlers, often in tears. The message accompanying these images were of the emotions felt by the settlers and soldiers at the final end to the Israeli settler presence in Gaza. Is there more to this story? We are very fortunate to have with us today, from her home in Holland, Professor Tanya Reinhardt. Tanya Reinhardt is professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University and at Utrecht University in Holland. She publishes a regular column on Israeli political affairs for the Hebrew language daily Yediot Aharonot, and she is author of a book which should be required reading for anyone interested in these topics, Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. Professor Reinhardt, thank you for joining us today.
Great, a pleasure.
Professor Reinhardt, one of your recent columns is titled How We Left Gaza, in which you argue that the U.S., the Bush administration, played a role in these recent events. Perhaps we could start with that article. What do you think lies behind the recent withdrawal and evacuation of Israeli settlers from Gaza?
Right. The standard picture is that Sharon simply decided that he wants to evacuate Gaza, announced it a year and a half ago, and the prevailing interpretation is that he decided to sacrifice Gaza in order to strengthen his hold in the West Bank. It's true that when he announced the plan in February 2004, it was in the peak of international criticism of Israel. So that's when the International Court of Justice started discussions of the wall that Israel was building, and there was disappointment in the world from the failure of the roadmap that actually Israel has failed. And it could be that he announced this plan in order to ease it's clear even that he announced this plan in order to ease international pressure. The question, however, was whether he originally actually intended to carry out this plan. Of course, we can never know what he has in mind, but if we look at both Sharon's past history and also the way that the preparations for the disengagement developed in Israel, there are various reasons to suspect that Sharon actually wants to carry it out. So there were many signs that could not be consistent with operations of a government determined on actually going through with it. The biggest puzzle, which is not that much discussed, is the fact that the settlers, in fact, never got compensations until the very last minute. So the whole machine of preparing the compensation was working. There was a law passed in the Israeli parliament, the compensation law, and although formally already 6 months ago, in principle, the settlers could get compensated, they were not given the money. There were similarly no preparations for the absorption in any other place. So, in fact, no preparation was, nothing that requires investment or anything was actually done. So, up until now, now the settlers were all moved to temporary residence and they were not paid. By contrast, if we look at the previous evacuation of settlements in Yamit, which was returned to Egypt during the peace agreement with Egypt, all settlers were compensated at least 3 months before and left before the evacuation. So there were only a few hardcore resistance settlers there and many who came from outside, but none of the original settlers. So this did not happen now. So that would suggest that perhaps Sharon was postponing the actual compensation till the very last minute, so in case he can get away with even this evacuation. And if he was hoping that he eventually may pull out of his words, and not out of Gaza, but out of his promises, he had very good reasons to believe it might be possible. If you look at the record of U.S.-Israel relations from before that time, during Sharon and previous government, so the nearest event where this was shown is the roadmap, the whole issue surrounding the roadmap. So the roadmap that Israel signed requires, in the first stage, leaving the future, in the first stage it requires restoring calm, so there would be a ceasefire of both sides. And during the first stages of the roadmap, Israel should restore the situation as it was in October 2000 and the end of September 2000, before the present round of violence and of the second Palestinian uprising. The Palestinians did keep their part of the roadmap. At that time, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, was also serving prime minister. Arafat was still around, but he was elected a functioning prime minister. And all Palestinian organizations declare Hudna, a ceasefire, which they kept quite strictly for several months. But so that was fulfilling their part of the roadmap. But Israel under Sharon and the army didn't keep any of the promises that were given during the roadmap. So specifically, the army kept invading towns and cities, and most seriously, the policy of liquidation, of assassination, just continued. So Israel kept provoking, in fact, the Palestinians' Islamic organizations by assassinating their leaders. And that went on for a while. So there was one assassination after the other between June 2003, when the Hudna, the ceasefire was declared, and August 2003 when it was broken. And so they, and particularly the match, maybe that blew the fire then, was assassinating Abu Shanab, who was a Hamas leader in Gaza, and not a member of the armed faction of Gaza, but the political faction. So that was the one thing that the Hamas organization could not control. In a way, they could not control their people there, and there was a big terror attack afterwards, and that was the thing that blew up the stage of the roadmap. After that, Israel started assassinating all of Hamas leadership, including Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, and the situation just reverted back to terror on the one hand and Israeli oppression on the other, and there was no sign of the roadmap.
But now leading up to that Hamas response, the string of provocations that you had mentioned by the Sharon government, the Bush administration did not respond against those, did not bring pressure to bear to try to get the Israeli government not to engage in those kinds of provocative acts.
Exactly. At that round of the roadmap, after the Aqaba summit and the Palestinian ceasefire, and during the previous round of Mahmoud Abbas's prime minister, the U.S. fully backed Israel. So the major claim of Israel was that it's not enough that Abbas guarantees a ceasefire. He has to actively, physically fight the Hamas organization. That in more direct terms, there was this expectation that he will be engaged in some kind of a civil war, for which also he didn't have the ability to do that, but also no Palestinian leader would engage in active civil war. So rather, the policy of Abbas at the time, and also of all Palestinian organizations, was to guarantee ceasefire and stick to it, but not to start fighting each other. The U.S. did back Israel's demand that Abbas more actively fights terror, but more, even worse, they never had any word of criticism about this liquidation policy, the assassination. So, and there was, in June 22, there was an assassination of head of a Hamas organization in Hebron, Abdullah Kawasme. That was shortly after the Palestinians declared the ceasefire. So Powell, that was then the Secretary of State, we are talking about the previous Bush administration, his first reaction was critical of the operation, and he said that he was sorry for the killing of Abdullah Kawasme, which he considers to have been unnecessary and a possible impediment to progress for peace. But then immediately the Bush administration clarified to Israel, even that same night, that Secretary of State Powell did not condemn the IDF killing, and all he wanted to say was expressing sorrow for both sides. So, and that is how it continued. Eben Sharon declared that Abbas is not carrying out war on terror, on the terrorist organizations and on Hamas. The U.S. kept backing him, and every assassination operation, even though it was clear that the ceasefire is going to be blown, the U.S. said just Israel has the right to defend itself. So there was no, there was full backing of everything Israel did. And another thing, the one concrete thing that Sharon was required to do during the roadmap, another concrete promise he get, was to dismantle just the illegal outposts. So these are not settlements, these are outposts.
These are the sort of things like, you know, small trailers or mobile homes that are set up very quickly on a mountaintop.
Right. And what he had to dismantle were those that were built after September 2000, so during during the last Palestinian uprising. That was that's a very simple thing to do, that's a clear commitment he gave, and he didn't do that. And again, the previous Bush administration, which was also before the elections in the U.S., has never done anything about that. So it seems like the U.S. would be always pretty happy about having some kind of a peace plan around, with peace ceremonies and negotiations and big promises, but is never requiring delivery of promises. That was the background for before. So based on that, I would say that Sharon maybe was hoping that it would be exactly the same this time.
And as you say, he had very good reason to believe it would be the same this time.
Based on past experience. And in fact, this experience is going back to history. The U.S. policy was always supportive of Israel. They always were taking Israel's side. But specifically this administration, the Bush administration, has been viewed in Israel as the best, the most friendliest, the friendliest to Israel that there ever was. So Bush was described as the most supportive president of Israel.
So it seemed as though Sharon could renege again on this Gaza withdrawal, and yet in the last, quite recently, of course, we've been seeing that the withdrawal has gone forward. What has changed?
Right. So what I believe has changed is that this time the Bush administration has put pressure. And the reason why Sharon and the Israeli army were certain they can do whatever they want was that during this new phase of Bush and his war against terror, they believe that Israel is really an asset because there aren't so many states that are willing to risk their people for U.S. operations, but the Israeli army was willing, and for example, to fight Iran. And there were all kinds of plans leaked to the media, Israeli media, but also British media, about military operations planned in Iran by the U.S., in which Israel would be a serious part. So there was this feeling in Israel of partnership with the U.S. and great expectations for something happening in Iran. But what happened since this year, since 2005, was that the U.S. affairs in Iraq were not going as good, as well as planned. The Iraq resistance, the U.S. has been absorbing losses and defeats, and things were not going well. And specifically, Iran, that after the war with Iraq, was ready for any terms of surrender. They were willing to sign any agreement the U.S. would propose, and the U.S. dragged at that time. But Iran drew encouragement from the resistance in Iraq, and also from its ties from the Shiites in Iraq. And during that time, also the oil agreements with China gave a boost to its economy and to its status. So all of a sudden, it became less obvious that it's possible to attack Iran. And at the same time, the criticism of the Bush administration in the U.S. was growing. And internationally, the problem of Iraq has been tied in people's consciousness with the problem of Palestine. So every time you had a big terror attack, say in Europe, in Spain, or in London, always you would hear afterwards the pair of words, Iraq and Palestine. So it was clear that the Palestinian issue is viewed in the Islamic world as the same as another aspect of the Iraq occupation or the U.S. policy. And I think that under these circumstances, with things in Iraq going so poorly and with expansion of the war to Iran seeming not fully realistic at the moment, the U.S. felt, Bush administration felt, they need at least to gain one, to calm the situation a bit in one area. So Bush will not give up on Iraq so quickly, but this headache of Palestine is something that he could more easily, he doesn't really need it. So I think the U.S. in a way trapped Sharon in his words this time. So since he made this commitment of pulling out of Gaza, they insisted that he actually does it. Now, we are used to, the words U.S. pressure became empty words over the years. We are used for this being just words with no muscles. But what happened now, if you look at what happened the few months before the evacuation in U.S.-Israel relations, you see that it wasn't business as usual. So the first thing, which is a step that you can describe it as a step, was silencing the pro-Israel lobby and AIPAC. So two former officials of AIPAC, of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, have been indicted on charges of assisting transferring of classified information to an Israeli representative. So that is, in effect, it's equivalent to working in the service of a foreign state. So it's a very serious charge, and if they are convicted, this would be a real serious blow for AIPAC. In any case, in the meanwhile, as long as there are all these charges in the air, AIPAC must sit quietly no matter what the Bush administration does to Israel. So this was the silencing of the most active lobby in Washington, and they are silent.
Do you think that incident, which got a little bit of coverage here, but certainly hasn't had any kind of, it hasn't been the object of a sustained kind of news reporting here in the United States, nothing like, for example, if it had been, you know, the activities of some other government. This has happened before, of course, with the Jonathan Pollard case.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that the Bush administration either aggressively pursued this, or even an incident that they might have let pass in the past, they decided to actually make an issue of in order to neutralize the pro-Israel lobby, in this case AIPAC?
Yeah. Well, the timing is, I mean, there was a question of about 2 years whether there would be, that would be taken to court. It's not, the way it's done quietly, and the addressee of this is precisely AIPAC. And if you look at publications of the, so like the internet magazine Forward, which is the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S., you know, that's where they are interviewed and they express their opinion, you can see that they are worried. So they feel the way they now talk about this administration is that it's the worst and most difficult that Israel ever had. So the effect, in any case, on AIPAC is that AIPAC now has to keep low profile. I cannot have an exact opinion on how it was decided, and we don't have the information how and when it was decided to pursue this, but it's a fact that AIPAC is now under scrutiny, and they are keeping quiet. Right? They are not criticizing any of the... But that is just for the internal, for you internal U.S. There's also no overt pressure on Israel, because the way the U.S. is doing it what I'm saying is that they forced Sharon to keep his word, but he's getting full credit as if that's what he was planning to do. So there is no overt clash between Israel and the U.S. So the pressure was prior to the evacuation, and there were sequence of steps that the U.S. administration took to guarantee that Sharon this time has to comply.
You mentioned, for example, a visit by Condoleezza Rice. Could you describe that? Suggested that was an incident in which the Bush administration was essentially laying down the law that they were going to go through with the Gaza pullout.
Right. So one other reason you may have to be suspicious that Sharon actually intended to go ahead with the evacuation was that the Israeli media was full for already about 2-3 months with information about a big military operation planned in July in Gaza. So it had the name Iron Fist, and you had ample information. So there was in the planning a big military operation that was scheduled for July, and the idea was that it would be activated by some terror attack. And given that Israel kept its policy of both assassinating and arresting and interfering in the territories, this terror attack also did come. And the operation was actually about to start. And then what I'm basing is this interpretation of Rice's visit is a New York Times article from, I think it was August 7, by Stephen Erlanger. And they interviewed several U.S. officials, and for example, the Middle East Security Coordinator, General William Ward, he told the New York Times that he confirmed that 2 weeks ago, namely before 2 weeks before August 7, American pressure had stayed the Israeli military when it was poised to go into Gaza. And that is when, in July 20, Rice appeared in Jerusalem. And there were descriptions of this visit also in Israeli media. It was very unfriendly and very tough. And Ward, in the same interview, also says that there could be similar pressure should the need arise. And he added that that scenario, the scenario of pressure, is a scenario that none of us would like to see. And he added there is a deep realization on the part of the Israeli leadership, including the military, about the consequences of that type of scenario. So the words pressure and threats were on the table at the time. And that all was on the background of another ongoing serious pressure, which was formerly around arms deals with China. So Israel has violated the sanctions on China before, but usually that would end up within a month or so by some U.S. Demand that would be kept. But this time, also for several months, the U.S. applied real sanctions, presumably on that affair. So they froze military agreements, they froze development of joint projects, stopped purchasing arms and also selling. So there was a real pressure around this thing. And you could find descriptions about doors in Washington closing to Israeli military personnel or even political personnel. So there was a feeling that this time the U.S. is serious, and in fact the operation was canceled and Sharon did carry out the evacuation.
So that is interesting and certainly news. Before I read your column, which was published, an English translation is published here on the ZNet website for folks who want to take a look at the column. There is an English translation available on the ZNet website. But this idea that actual cutoff of some kind of moratorium on military aid to Israel, the sort of business as usual, had somehow significantly changed, that's something that we haven't heard of before here, at least certainly not widely in the commercial news system here. We haven't heard this reported.
That probably was between the lines, but all connected with the China arms deal. It was not described as pressure on Israel to evacuate Gaza, but as pressure on Israel to cancel the deal with China. But Israel long was the sanctions applied following that deal with China were much more severe than in the past. So all this freezing, these are temporary freezing, right? Not cancellation, freezing of military projects. Mm. Right? This was the sanctions. And incidentally, now you, after the evacuation, you hear that they are going to be renewed, all these military projects that were cancelled. So you probably could read this between the lines, but yeah, maybe more in this in places like Forward, the more pro-Israel type of publications that were more worried about this. So, and in Israeli media.
Well, I wonder if we could talk a little bit more broadly about this question of the evacuation of Gaza, even though this may have been the key to understanding why Sharon did, in fact, evacuate the settlers from Gaza, that is the U.S. pressure. It does seem to solve an issue that has come up in other discussions of why Israel's policy has shifted on Gaza and has finally withdrawn these settlers that have been there for quite a long time, and that is that what's euphemistically referred to as the demographic problem in Israel, and that is very large Palestinian populations within territories that Israel has been occupying since 67. This, of course, is still a problem in the West Bank, and the idea of so-called Gaza first has been on the table for a long time. Do you think that Sharon sees this as a significant setback? I mean, it may well be that he had to be pressured to get out of Gaza, but does he see this as a significant setback, or rather is he turning it into an opportunity in terms of expanded and more aggressive policies with respect to the settlements in the West Bank?
No, that's obvious, and he's saying that. He's saying that, obviously, that this is the last, that this would enable us to keep the West Bank settlements, and mainly the one thing that happened from the start was that the condition for that Israel put to the U.S. for its planned evacuation was a completion of the wall in the West Bank, which is the one thing that they've done very efficiently. So that is clear that he chose Gaza because obviously when he declared he will evacuate Gaza, he must have also taken into account the possibility that he will have to do that. Right? This is, it's not guaranteed that you can forever just breach all your agreements and get away with this. So obviously that is the least, the smallest sacrifice in order to keep the rest. All I'm saying is that up to Sharon, he wouldn't have given up also Gaza, because there's a very serious question of how to maintain the occupation. And to begin with, Israel never planned, so if you're asking about the demographic issue, that would be relevant if Israel really ended the occupation of Gaza and let Gaza complete freedom, and then they are not in the responsibility of Israel. All agreements, the evacuation plan to begin with stated that Israel would maintain full control of Gaza. Gaza will be isolated from the sea and from Egypt and fully controlled by Israel. So Israel is not giving up the occupation of Gaza, in fact. It's only taking out the settlements. So I don't see that the demographic issue could be. In any case, it's clear that the real battle is only beginning, and first Israel did not end its occupation in Gaza, and they have a very good reason, because Sharon's fear is that if he really opens Gaza to the world and gives Gaza some sort of independence, they would be the center of Palestinian resistance. That would be a big boost to the Palestinian movement that will keep demanding also full fulfillment of UN resolutions and Israel's getting out of the territory. So he's not giving up control of Gaza, right? It's really gaining some international bonus, and it in my view it's significant, because Gaza is the most crowded strip of land in the world, and giving back a third of the land to the Palestinians is a positive thing, right? But the occupation goes on.
So as you say, the occupation goes on in spite of the fact that these settlers have been evacuated from the settlements in Gaza. When you say the occupation continues, does this mean that Israeli troops are very likely to go back into Gaza, or are you referring to, for example, control of the borders, and perhaps this also includes the border with Egypt?
Right. The plan of the Gaza withdrawal, as appeared in the Israeli media well over a year ago, says also that Israel keeps the right to enter to military operations inside Gaza, all coded in language of security in order to protect its security and so on. But also, it in the original plan, Israel intends to keep the strip along the border with Egypt. That's another area of debate currently with the U.S. administration, but I'm not sure how persistent the U.S. will be about this point. So what remains to be seen is what will happen in the coming few months in Gaza itself. I'm pretty sure that as far as Israel is concerned, they will try to have a military operations both there and in the West Bank. Well, in the West Bank, there was just this week a big assassination in Tul Karem. But sticking to Gaza, Israel's plan is, on the one hand, and that was also in the Israeli papers, right from the start, Eland, who is the Giora Eland, he was in charge of the disengagement office and plan. And he explained right from the start that once we carry out the disengagement, we would not be formally occupiers. So Israel's plan is that the Gaza Strip would be declared no longer occupied, but it would still be fully military controlled by Israel. And the idea is clear, because by the Geneva Conventions, the occupier is responsible for the occupied people. So he's responsible for every aspect of their well-being, and specifically their nutrition, their health care, their quality of life, their property. This is all the responsibility of the occupier. If Israel manages to get this special status to Gaza, this would mean it could still do whatever it does militarily inside Gaza and keep suffocating the Palestinians there and pushing them to starvation and poverty. But at the same time, it would all become legal, because they are not occupiers.
How do you see the Palestinian Authority responding to this turn of events? If indeed this occupation is continuing in all but name, what do you think the options are for the Palestinian Authority, and what do you think they're actually going to be doing in this situation?
Well, they have already declared that they oppose to Israel is planning to ask the UN to declare that occupation is, I don't know if they will do it, these are just news of the last week, planning to ask the UN declaring that the occupation is over, and the Palestinian Authority has already declared its opposition. So the occupation is not over until it's over, if indeed Israel gets out completely and is not allowed to get in, and the Palestinians are free to in Gaza, are free to have their contacts with whoever they want. You may declare the occupation over, but not just getting out the settlements is not doing that. So the Palestinians are saying all that all the time, and as part of this, what appears to be a more serious attitude of the U.S., the U.S. administration right now is saying that Israel should give more freedom to Gaza. But I think the big show that the U.S. needed has happened already, and I don't know if we can expect them to. Right now, the U.S., this week, the U.S., first Rice and then Bush, they keep repeating that now that Sharon disengaged, the Palestinians have to start fighting the terror organizations. So far, right now, it seems that that's it for a while, but we cannot know. This aspect is what we don't know.
You mentioned that we've just seen a big show, and I wonder if we could wrap up this interview with the discussion of how these events have been covered in the commercial media. Now, of course, you're in Holland, so I don't know what media you see.
Yeah, but the media is one media all over the world. There's always one media. I don't think there's a difference, substantial difference between European and American.
And what's your view of how these events have been covered in the commercial media worldwide?
Yeah, that's the shared themes are first the heroic gesture of Sharon. Sharon is a real man of peace who is facing opposition from inside, but he's determined to start ending the occupation, and he has done this big act for peace. Then the focus is on the big sacrifice of the Israelis, right? It's the victims of this event seem to be the settlers who were evacuated from their homes, and there's very little mention of how many Palestinians lost their homes over the years of occupation. And now, just if you just take since the disengagement plan, Israel still kept destroying hundreds of houses in the Gaza Strip. So probably more Palestinian houses were destroyed in Gaza than ever than the settlers. And there's very little talk of what the settlers were doing there to begin with, and what type of misery they were causing to their neighbors. But with all this said, I think you could say that also this cheerful tone that which the event is described with cheerful tone. There is a real feeling of relief that this is happening. I think this is true for both European and American media. There is also a sense of relief, and I think if you look under just the mainstream, there is big readiness in the world to see Israel getting out from all of the territories and not just from Gaza. And you get the feeling that in some of the reports or in the BBC, and you get the feeling that there is a hope it's only the first step, that it would not be the last step.
So in that respect, I mean, that is something of a positive outcome, that the withdrawal from Gaza has, in a sense, encouraged the view that this is a first
possible,
step.
That it's possible. The view that it's actually a first step is dangerous, because if you leave it up to Israel, that is not the first step, it's the last step. But it showed that it's possible, and I think on this, the view of many people in the world is that it should be the first step, that if Israel got out of some settlements, it's something that never happened before in the history of the occupation of the Palestinian areas, that it evacuated settlements on Palestinian land, that it can continue. Also, I think if what I said here, if what I said about the U.S. this time putting real pressure, I think this is a very significant thing to the anti-war movement in general, because what it means is the struggle against Bush policy and the resistance to this constant war are making things more difficult. And then there should be some concession somewhere to the opposition. And if the concession is on Palestine, it's a big achievement to the anti-war movement. And I think in this sense, it is. The situation is slightly more optimistic than it was a few months ago.
Well, I want to give you a chance to wrap up this interview with any thoughts that you have that you want in particular a U.S. audience to hear. And it could have, of course, to do with this Gaza pullout, but it could have more generally to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict.
I think what I just said was my message to... I believe that... I repeat what I just said, because this is, I think, what I have to say to the U.S. audience. I think the encouraging lesson of this event, these events, is that struggle is paying off. So first, the Palestinian cause, although it was dismissed from the media, although it is ignored, it's still there. People are still... Palestine is still remembered. And I believe that what we see here is that the struggle on Iraq and the Middle East is connected to the struggle on Palestine. These are the two occupations, the Iraq occupation and the occupation of Palestine, should end. And the struggle to end the one is always also helping the struggle to end the other.
Professor Reinhardt, thank you very much for spending this time with us today.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I'm William Seaman. This has been a special KBOO Public Affairs feature focused on Israel-Palestine. Thank you for listening.